From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm David Watts Barton, editor-in-chief of SacramentoPress.com, sitting in for Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, new entertainment options open on K Street, the supposed link between vaccines and autism, and a new film about the artist Peter Lee Brownlee. But first, now that we've had a week to examine Governor Jerry Brown's draft budget proposal, do the numbers add up? Will the budget actually be fixed this time? And what does that mean for California's overall economy? We're going to talk about that now with Stephen Levy, senior economist and the director of the Center for Continuing Study of the California Economy in Palo Alto. He joins us by phone. Stephen Levy, welcome to Insight.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm fine.
How does this budget look to you? We've had a week to look at it. What do you think?
I think it's honest. The numbers work. It's a five-year workout plan with a lot of permanent solutions up front, some temporary ones that will be phased out as the economy recovers. But it's the first budget we've had in a long time where, so to speak, you could take the numbers to the bank. So the math works. We'll have to see how people react to it. As proposed, it works. We'll see what happens when it's finally adopted.
When you say permanent solutions, there's been a lot of talk about the sort of temporary fixes and patching holes and one-time fixes. What are the big changes in this one that add up?
There are, unfortunately, from my perspective, some cuts in the Medi-Cal program, in the CalWORKs, which is the welfare to work program, in some of the other safety net programs. There are cuts right now that I hope will be replaced eventually in the UC and CSU and community college system. There are some proposals for permanent tax changes around enterprise zones and the corporate income tax, and there is the five-year proposal that is the centerpiece for extending the tax increases adopted 2 years ago for 5 years until the economy recovers.
And was there anything that surprised you in this?
No. There's an enormous amount of pain and challenge because the economy has tanked and revenues are down, and the budget is about allocating that pain between taxpayers and public services and the people who get public services. The only point that I was disappointed in, although I really understand it, is the cuts to higher education. The governor protected as best he could K-12, and I view education as our investment in the future. So I hope that the higher education cuts are reversed as soon as possible.
Now, you study, you're the director of the Center for the Continuing Study of the California Economy in Palo Alto. How does the budget fit into the economy? What's the relative size of the government's budget versus the gross state product of California?
Sure. About a nickel of all of the output, every dollar of output we produce, about 5 cents out of each dollar of gross state product is the state budget. It's about $100 billion, and our gross state product is about $2 trillion. So it's about a nickel out of a dollar. There are two ways that the budget affects the economy in the sense of fostering prosperity. One is it is the major source of public investment in education, and a trained workforce is really critical both for residents to share in the prosperity and for us to be able to offer firms talented workers. So it's a major investment in education and in infrastructure. But the second is kind of a interesting way, which is an honest budget, one that puts the state on the road to honest balance. The five-year workout plan will remove one of the biggest challenges, I think, to our prosperity and business climate environment, that is we become known as the state that can't patch a budget, can't agree on water, can't agree on much of anything. And so if we agree on an honest budget, I think our credit rating will improve, we'll pay less interest for bonds, and investors around the world will finally begin to once again see California as the state that can and wants to progress in the future.
And that's the first thing you mentioned, the source of public education is pretty concrete. The second is a little bit more an image issue?
Well, it's certainly not as concrete, but the tie to the bond ratings and how much interest we pay is very concrete. We're paying a lot more interest now because lenders are worried about our ability to balance the budget and pay it back, so an honest budget will lower the interest costs that we pay on all of the debt from now on. And I think it's an important signal. I think California has to once again become the state that can find agreement on issues. Mm-hmm. And agreement that's honest. We've agreed on a bunch of budgets in the past where kind of everybody at the end while they were signing the budget knew that the numbers didn't add up. This proposal, painful as it is, does add up.
Now, the Republican caucus in the government here in Sacramento has said that they are not going to vote for the extension of these taxes because that would amount to a tax raising taxes. How do you see it working without that?
Well, I'm an economist, not a politician.
Mm-hmm.
It's a standard response. It's what conservatives said in 2009 before they agreed to the current taxes that we're proposing to extend. It's always the beginning of a discussion. As I said, I'm not much of a politician. I read in the paper that the governor may be able to get it on the ballot for voters to choose with less than a two-thirds majority. It's kind of like what the health care bill did in the Congress, where we finally ended up passing it with a majority vote, not a 60 votes in the Senate. So mm-hmm. I don't know about the politics. I think voters should get to decide. That's what the governor has said. I think it's a reasonable position. I think the case should be with the voters as to whether they're willing to extend these taxes to preserve the public services. It's really a citizenship issue.
I'm speaking with Stephen Levy, who is an economist who specializes in California's economy. Is California unique in all this, or is it just bigger here because we're bigger?
Illinois just raised their personal income tax by two-thirds to fend off a much larger percentage-wise budget deficit. Texas, which is supposed to be the state that's the greatest for job and economic growth, and I applaud Texas, has a budget deficit nearly as large as ours in dollar terms. Budget deficits are, in most states and in most cities, the recession has just wreaked havoc. California, I think, gets the rap, one, because we're larger, and because, two, there's kind of a game of California bashing that goes on among people.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not, by any means, the largest state deficit. And just to throw out a number, our deficit is 1% of our gross state product. That's what the $20 billion is. The United States is now running a deficit that's 10%. Greece is 12%, France is 9%, Spain is 8%, and here we have this 1% deficit and we're treating it like something awful. It's more politics than money at that level.
A lot of times when when these things are discussed and they talk about solutions, they build in overly optimistic projections of how the economy is going to respond. And right now, people are not feeling particularly positive about the economy and particularly real estate. What do you think about the assumptions in the budget about how the economy itself is going to do and how that will affect revenues?
Yeah, that's the question I usually get asked. I think these are slightly conservative. The Ledge analyst has slightly higher numbers. They're very much in line with the low end of what most of the national forecasting firms are saying. I realize that everybody's worried, and as economists, we have a terrible forecasting record, but this is a budget not based on optimistic revenue projections. No way.
Sacramento is the capital, and our economy here is significantly dependent on government jobs. How do you think this budget is going to affect that? We've already had furlough Fridays, and a lot of people have been hit, particularly in the downtown area. How do you see this affecting Sacramento's economy specifically?
I think Sacramento is in for at least a couple of very rough years, both from the housing situation, where we're not going to see building anytime soon. And anyway this budget is resolved, there's going to be less money to spend by public employees. The government is Sacramento's biggest industry, and it is in retrenchment right now. It's going to take at least a couple of years before Sacramento can see any sustained recovery.
And do you think we're going to see ultimately a smaller government, fewer public employees, fewer programs?
No, I think we'll see fewer programs at the state level. A major part of this budget is to send some services down to the local level. I guess the poster child is the county jail system has empty beds. The state prison system is very expensive and swamped. So one idea is to send some low-risk state prisoners down to the county jails. That'll both save money. We'll send the revenue along with it. So there'll be some transfers among jurisdictions. I don't think anybody wants to see fewer teachers, nurses, librarians in the school system. We're very, very short-staffed as it is. So I think there'll be major realignment with maybe some cost savings and efficiency, but I don't see overall state and local government getting smaller.
I'm speaking with Stephen Levy of the Center for the Continuing Study of the California Economy. Another potential area of cuts that Jerry Brown has talked about, it sounds like 100% cuts, is of redevelopment funds and redevelopment agencies, which
right.
at this time in the cycle seem to be something that are pretty useful. At least here in Sacramento, we have several projects that are built largely on redevelopment funds. What do you think what's your position on those?
As an economist, I favor it. I think the redevelopment projects, at least the ones that are soundly based, are very important. And so the other part of the redevelopment proposal is that local governments have the authority to pass bonds or raise taxes to fund their local redevelopment efforts. The problem here is that the state doesn't have enough money to support the redevelopment efforts. The state has to backfill the money that's lost to schools. And so if local redevelopment wants to go on, it should probably be funded locally, and the governor proposes to give people the authority to do that. So I don't think it's about redevelopment or not redevelopment. It's about who should support the diversion of tax revenues that goes with redevelopment from cities and counties and schools, which are strapped very hard.
Mm-hmm. Are you optimistic?
I am more hopeful than I've been in the past 3 years because of the tone of the governor, the fact that the numbers add up, and the fact that he's just explaining it to people. Ultimately, voters have to make the decisions about this, about what kind of state they want and what they're willing to pay, and I think we've moved to a new level of honesty amidst the pain. People can take a lot of hard times if they're treated honestly. So I'm hopeful about the economy, but I'm also hopeful that we're going to have a more honest and involved dialogue about these big choices about taxes and public spending.
Well, thank you for joining us. Stephen Levy is a senior economist and the director of the Center for the Continuing Study of the California Economy in Palo Alto. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, three new entertainment venues finally open on K Street. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Check us out on Facebook and become one of our fans. Our page is Insight on Capital Public Radio. The effort to revitalize downtown Sacramento's K Street is getting a long-awaited boost tonight and next week. Two nightclubs and a flashy new pizza restaurant are opening across K Street from the Crest Theater between 10th and 11th Streets. The venues have been several years in the making and cost nearly $5 million in private and public money, and they've been controversial from the start. San Francisco entrepreneur George Carpati is the owner and operator of these new venues, Pizza Rock, District 30, and Dive Bar. I spoke with him yesterday at Dive Bar on the eve of the opening of his three businesses. I asked him why, after years of success in the Bay Area, he decided to open a business in Sacramento.
I thought it'd be a good opportunity to bring some different nightlife to town.
You've done clubs in San Francisco and the East Bay. How is your approach different here in Sacramento?
Well, you know, the company's always evolving, so we're always looking to do something different, creative, and we had some ideas, you know, in storage, so to speak, and the opportunities arose, so we thought we'd execute them and roll them out.
You've got three adjacent venues here. Why don't you tell us about each one?
Well, one of them is Dive Bar, which is kind of a vintage-looking dive bar with a little bit of a twist on it, which would be the dive word. So we have a huge indoor aquarium. It's about 7,500 gallons, saltwater tank, lots of beautiful fish, and an occasional appearance by a mermaid.
And merman?
On occasion.
What are the other two?
There's Pizza Rock in the middle. It's a partnership between me and Tony Gimignani from San Francisco. It's a fun pizza restaurant, homemade pastas, lots of salads, some great burgers. Four different pizza ovens. We have a wood-burning pizza oven that can make pizza in 90 seconds. And we added kind of a nightlife twist to it, so we play rock anthems and music and a variety format, stay open late, late-night dining, do some fun things on the video screens. It's just a high-energy pizza restaurant.
And how late when you say late?
We'll be up until 3 or 4 in the morning, Wednesday through Saturday.
Oh, wow. Till 3 or 4? At the Pizza Rock or all three of them?
The other two will be open until 3 in the morning, and Pizza Rock 3 or 4.
Okay, and then the third venue is?
The third venue is District 30. It's our boutique dance lounge. Beautiful space, amazing sound system, and great music.
And the District 30 name was a sort of a substitute name for the original name that we heard, which was?
It was Frisky Rhythm. You know, sometimes I still love the name, but I'm here to make sure my customers are happy. And I was one of the few people that liked the name, so we kind of revisited it. We kind of have a demo at District 30 for the 25 to young 30 crowd. District 30 sounded like a cool name. We're in the entertainment district, so we came up with that name. It seemed to have gone over much better than Frisky Rhythm.
Now, and is the District 30 referring to over 30s, or is that?
No. It's just a number. Really, it's just a number. We're a 21 and older venue, so the perfect demo for that music format will probably be, you know, 25 to early 30.
And what kind of music will that be in there?
We play purely electronic dance on Thursdays. On Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday, it's a variety top 40 format with a lot of electro and house mixed in.
I want to go back to Tony as well, because he has quite a history as a pizza maker, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he was a 9-time gold medal acrobatic pizza champion, as well as the, you know, winner of best pizza in Naples, for the Margherita Pizza, the Calitalia Pizza. He's got a lot of trophies, a lot of medals. He's quite the pizza artisan.
You've done a lot of detail work on these places. I mean, they're exquisite. Could you tell us a little bit about some of the details that you put into the three different places?
A lot of details. I mean, we're just that kind of a company that is focused on the details. The venues all look completely unique and different, and they're fun. And, you know, we like fun to be a little bit high-end, so we have some cool accoutrement. The bottle service tables and some of the arches are Japanese zebra wood. There's some unique finishes. There's some electric glass behind the bar that changes color, and then it's opaque and then becomes translucent. There's artwork behind it. We intend on the front of District 30 that kind of being a living, breathing piece of art that evolves and changes and isn't stagnant but offers something unique to look at every few months. Dive Bar's got some lush furnishings and some, you know, the fish tank, obviously. We took some care and detail in the bathrooms, walls, carpet, woodwork. You know, people should just come out and walk around a little bit.
This was a very long process. 3 years. Mm-hmm. And it was very involved. It was involved with redevelopment money, and it's on the most difficult street in town that could be something. What inspired you to come to K Street specifically?
Well, we'd come up about 5 years ago to look at some possible opportunities. Nothing really panned out. And came back about 3 years ago when this opportunity came up. And one of the deciding factors was, you know, there's some great businesses around us. So if you look at Cosmo and the theater, Social Nightclub, Polari, the Joie de Vie property, Kip and Chip, I know Chip calling from San Francisco, the Citizen Hotel, Ella. So we felt that there was, and many others, but we felt that we weren't first on the island, and you don't want to be last, and we thought we could really contribute and be a part of the growing resurgence of K Street.
And how do you picture this? You're a savvy businessman. You've been doing this for a while, and you've made a substantial investment in this area. About how much was invested in this place?
A lot more than I thought. That'd be an over budget statement. So we probably on our end are into this close to $3 million now.
And there was redevelopment money as well.
There was some redevelopment money that went into the buildings. It's a partnership between CIM and David Taylor interest. So we pulled together and put this project together.
And looking down, we're still in the middle of a recession. It's a tough time for business and to open something. Do you have an idea? We know that the 700 block is going to be developed in the next 2.5 years. Do you have an idea of how long it might take to sort of hang tough through this area? Do you think that this is going to be a destination that's going to bring this up? Do you have a plan or idea of how this is all going to unfold?
Yeah, well, one of the reasons we did what we did the way we did it, which is a little bit over the top, was to make it a destination. At no time did we think that any more nightlife, that we would just come to town and share the existing nightlife scene with everybody. We're not trying to take the scene that's here. We're trying to add to the scene, and that's going to take people coming from the Bay Area up to see shows here and come experience Dive Bar and a pretty wonderful pizza restaurant that's going to have a vibe. We've been lucky enough to get a lot of folks from Sacramento to come to Ruby Sky. So we think we can get them from Reno, Tahoe. I think the venues are that good. There's choices. There's, density brings density in nightlife. The more you have, the more people want to come. They can bounce around and have options. So just in our little neighborhood, there's 5 nightlife choices now. And then the other thing, this Chops restaurant around the corner, just like Ella, that was another deciding factor for us, is great restaurants that were doing fairly well, at least visually, when we were there and visiting during, 2 years ago when the recession was worse, led us to believe that if people are still going out and recognizing quality, that if you build it, they will come.
There was a lot of controversy at times over the place. You don't like that being pointed out. But there was a lot of controversy over the last few years, and people were resistant in different ways or making fun of the dive bar idea and the mermaids and all that. Was there ever any point where you thought, why am I doing this when I'm getting so much flack over it?
No. I think people made fun of, Richard Branson when he had some crazy ideas and Disney. And, there's no such thing as being creative without risk. So I didn't enjoy the controversy. It's behind us. We're basically focused on going forward and being positive, and we don't feel much controversy any longer.
Mm-hmm. What's your impression of Sacramento now? You've spent a lot of time up here. I don't know if you spent much time before. What do you think of Sacramento and downtown in particular?
I love it. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. My brother and sister-in-law and nephews have lived in Citrus Heights for 20 years, so it's not my first visit. Mm-hmm. But I like downtown better than the burbs.
And do you see, in terms of the support for what you're doing here, in terms of downtown partnership and the city government, do you feel like there's a lot of interest in what you're doing and that you're getting help?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of support and a lot of love and a lot of buzz. And I think the more that people experience us, and the energy that I think we're bringing to K Street, the more positive, vibes I think we'll feel. But I think there's a a good buzz out there. We've done some test runs. The staff is excited. We have an amazing crew. Feel really good about them. It's 125 people that just, you know, we've all drank the Kool-Aid.
125 people working here.
Yeah.
That's a good economic boost right there.
Yeah, I think so. And they're wonderful people.
I'm assuming that you like the idea of cars on K Street.
I like the cars idea very much, and the sooner the better. Life, you know, and getting activity on K Street is why we're here ourselves. We believe that the city's committed to K Street changing. The two developments down the road are a big factor. We kind of had some headway on that. We knew that was going to come. So I think that, you know, 3 years from today, it's a completely different K Street than it was for many, many years.
All right. Well, George Carpati, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
That was entrepreneur George Carpati, owner and operator of the three New Life nightlife venues opening this weekend on K Street in downtown Sacramento. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a controversial study that linked autism to children to some vaccinations has been debunked. We'll be right back. Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. For more about the people and topics on our show, go to capradio.org/insight. In 1998, a small English study of children with autism seemed to confirm that autism was caused by a widely used mumps and measles vaccine. The lead researcher in that study was Dr. Andrew Wakefield, and it was published in the English medical journal The Lancet. Wakefield's findings led to a big drop in immunizations in Europe and around the world. But several much larger studies since then have debunked Wakefield's conclusions, and even 10 of his co-authors have repudiated it. Last year, The Lancet formally retracted it, and a recent investigative story in London's Sunday Times claims that Wakefield actually faked the study. With me today is Judy Vanderwalter, an associate professor with the Mind Institute at UC Davis and an expert in autism. Judy Vanderwalter, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Why have so many people come to believe that autism is caused by vaccines?
Well, there's certainly been, I think, you know, before even Dr. Wakefield published that paper, I think there were concerns by parents that they seemed to see a timing issue of right about the time you would diagnose autism, they get the MMR vaccine, and actually they get the DTaP, the diphtheria, bordetella pertussis vaccine, and tetanus vaccine at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I think they seemed to see there was a relationship between, you know, my child had this vaccination and seemed to change almost overnight. And I think that probably is what led to some of the research issues that were then addressed by Dr. Wakefield in that paper.
It's an interesting, the difference between science and sort of common sense, right? When mm-hmm. you see cause and effect, and it doesn't necessarily mean that that's the cause.
Well, that's true. I think there are really two issues, and as long as we're discussing sort of the vaccine issue, one is does a vaccine cause autism? And a really, I think, more important issue, do children who have autism respond differently when they are immunized with a vaccine or even get sick? And I think that is probably, that's an issue that is worth addressing, that might give us a better insight into their biology. And I think that's one of the things that probably should be addressed.
There is some environmental evidence that some forms of autism are caused by environmental factors. Isn't that true?
There's certainly a lot of research in that area, and I think it's a very important area of research. One of the issues, you know, certainly thimerosal was one of the things that was thought to play a role, and that was present in vaccines. Mercury, you know, is in the environment, and fish consumption is largely what is responsible for the ingestion of mercury. I think there's no one would argue that mercury is not good for you. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, that it's good for you. But I think there are many, many other environmental contaminants besides that bear looking at. And I think sensitivity to those is probably one of the biggest issues that we are addressing now.
And I don't want to go back too far into the rehashing the whole thing, but could you describe his Wakefield's study? You know Dr. Wakefield.
I have met, yes, Dr.
Okay.
Wakefield.
Could you describe his study and why it was wrong?
Wow. I think without actually looking at the data carefully and looking at the samples that he looked at and going through the records as a scientist rather than a journalist, I think that is probably an issue that is worth addressing scientifically. I think the way that this was portrayed in the media was probably that would not be how I would have addressed it. I think the British Medical Journal might have been better served to have a team of scientists actually look at that information rather than going back and just looking at and interviewing people about it.
You're talking about the way it was handled back 10 years ago.
Recently, and I think, well, no, the study, oh, you're talking about the 10-year ago study. I mean, I've read the study, and I think it was unfortunate that I think so much was made of a small study and that it should have, you know, replication before having so much public, having it go so public would have been probably a good idea.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Judy Vanderwater, who is an associate professor at the Mind Institute at UC Davis. We're talking about the recent news of the supposed connection between autism and childhood vaccinations. You are an immunologist.
Mm-hmm.
And how does your work fit in with the Mind Institute?
Actually, I'm very fortunate to be part of the Mind Institute because really our goal there is to use as many disciplines as we can to understand what's going on with autism. We have an incredible group of behavioralists there. And we have people who do imaging, and my part of that is looking at the biology. And I think that is one thing that has come out of the early work by Dr. Wakefield is no one even thought about the biology prior to that, really. I mean, that's really how I got into it. Hmm. And I wouldn't have gotten into it if somebody hadn't questioned that there was something other than you're born that way. And I think so. My work really involves looking at how the immune system, which we know is involved in neurodevelopment, there's a very intricate relationship between how the brain develops and the immune system. Excuse me. And so we know we also are looking at the immune system of kids, and we know that we've seen some really profound differences in children with autism in some of the kids, not all of them. You have to remember, autism is a very heterogeneous disorder. There's probably a lot of ways you can get there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of manifestations. It's a behaviorally defined disorder. So now we're trying to parse out sort of, I guess we call them the phenotypes, the different phenotypes, and how autism differs amongst those under the umbrella of autism.
And what's the core quality that makes autism, many differences?
I mean, it's a behaviorally defined disorder that really is characterized by lack or difficulties in social and verbal communication. Those are probably the hallmarks of the disorder. Also, repetitive stereotypical behavior is another sort of hallmark of autism. Sometimes there are sort of issues with cognition, but the scale ranges. It's a very wide scale of you can have very high-functioning individuals with autism that have very productive lives, individuals with Asperger's, or down to individuals that have very difficult time with day-to-day living.
And is there still work going on looking at the link between autism and immunization?
I think one of the things that should be addressed is how children with autism respond to being immunized rather than does it cause autism?
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me, getting over a cold. and so I think one thing that we need to look at is we know that their immune systems and some of the kids are different, and that if you gave them a really strong immune challenge, you may see some changes in their behavior, or they may not do well. Some parents will say that they're down for a week after they had their shots. My son, who's 11 now, you couldn't even tell when he had a vaccination.
Hmm.
So, you know, that's a very different response from many of the typical kids. My work is also looking at just various aspects of their immune health and function. And we see some kids that have very poor immune systems and some that have perfectly normal immune systems, you know, to their typical peers. And then some that have, when we stimulate them, incredibly high responses. So that's a lot of what we're doing right now.
High response in the sense of?
Sort of more of what we call inflammation. So mm-hmm. that when we stimulate their cells produce a lot of what we call inflammatory factors rather than just sort of the typical response that we see in the typical kids.
I want to go back to what you said earlier about the media response, because a lot of times the translation from science to the media and to the public is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Why did his study, which has been now debunked, why did it get so much attention at the time?
At the time that it was first published? Or
at the time it was first published, and now that it's been debunked. I mean, it's sort of the bookends of this story.
I know, it's true. It's been out there for a while.
Because it sounded like you said a minute ago that the response now is being a little extreme as well. And so, you know, is there overcompensation coming back and saying, oh, we got it so wrong the first time, now we're going to come back and jump all over this guy?
You know, I don't know. I think what was thought to be best for public interest to reassure families that vaccination is safe for the most part, and that, you know, to try and help, because there has been certainly a large drop in vaccine usage, and which is unfortunate for many families, especially in the UK. You know, it's increased the incidence of measles mm-hmm. over there. And but I think my issues with sort of the current way that was done is it doesn't just call into question Dr. Wakefield, because I was actually reading the blogs on the website, you mm-hmm. know, of the BMJ, the British Medical Journal. And I think when you read through those blogs, then you can see it's chipping away at the for all of us, at sort of the public opinion of all research. You know, so does this happen everywhere?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do we know to trust it? How do we know what studies we can trust and what we can't trust? You know, so it's, I think that was an issue just as a scientist, mm-hmm. To have such a media sort of sensationalist approach to something that was typically a medical journal.
And was it that science wasn't allowed to run its course because that initial study was jumped on so quickly?
You mean the original study,
study.
And I think some of that may have been Dr. Wakefield saying, you know, we have found this great new thing. But you have to remember, the autism community is looking for something. You know, we're talking about children who, mm-hmm. you know, this is a lifelong disorder. And as a parent, you want to find an answer, and you want to find, what can I do? How do I fix this? You know, how do I make my child well?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's. I think it was a combination of factors.
I understand that one of the founders of the Mind Institute, Rick Rollins, is still a defender of Wakefield, and actually referred to some of this as a lynching. How does that work at the Mind Institute?
I know Rick actually well, and I think it is. I think there's. It's hard. It's hard to answer that. There's a lot of opinions at the Mind, and they don't obviously all agree
mm-hmm.
on that. And I mean, I know two of the founding parents, and they don't necessarily agree 100%. I think, but he's right in that there probably was a bit of a he was targeted. But I think there are a lot of people who feel what he did was dangerous. And mm-hmm. and I, as a matter of fact, I teach, you know, at UC Davis, I teach. My graduate students are social responsibility and science. I mean, that's one of the issues that I cover. And we just talked about this yesterday in class. It's like, you have a responsibility as a scientist to be very sure of your data. And we do the best we can. I mean, we're not always perfect. But to really make sure what you have is what you have, you know, to the best of your ability before you publish it and promote it, you know, in the public eye, because the public may not understand nuances
mm-hmm.
that the scientific community does.
Do you find it's been more than 12 years now since his original study, and you all have continued working? Do you find, are you getting any closer to understanding this in any significant ways? I mean, that felt like a big breakthrough that everybody's waiting for, and it turns out it wasn't. So can we see something more than that?
I think while that may not have been the breakthrough that they thought it was, it certainly was a breakthrough for the field, because for the first time people were looking into the biology mm-hmm. of autism. So that has opened a lot of doors for a lot of people. Myself included. And I think some work that's coming out of our lab, we're looking at maternal antibodies that are present during pregnancy that we've seen associated only in mothers who have children with autism. So that, for me, is a breakthrough. It's only 12% of the moms, but that may lead to a diagnostic test at some point in the future. So, yes, I think we have come a long way. We've gotten a better picture. We've got more people working on it. It's brought a lot of people into the field. People, I work with people I never would have worked with before, which is very satisfying.
Well, we wish you the best of luck on that.
Thank you.
Judy Vanderwater is an associate professor at the Mind Institute at UC Davis. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, filmmaker Wendy Elkin presenting her movie Painting Bellinas at the Sacramento Film and Music Festival this weekend. We'll speak with her when we come back. Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Insight streams live online. Check it out at capradio.org/insight. Filmmaker Wendy Elkin is presenting her film Painting Bellinas at the Sacramento Film and Music Festival this weekend. It's a full-length feature about a 90-year-old painter known as the cake decorator because of his massive layering technique. Wendy Elkin, welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having me.
What drew you to the art of Peter Lee Brownlee?
I was in Mill Valley as an art commissioner for the city, and I was putting on an event called the Click Off, a photography event. And I needed a thank you gift for all of the people that were entering the event. And I decided that I was looking around in a bookstore, and I saw these beautiful cards that had representations of these small townships all over America, really. And there was one of downtown Mill Valley, and I thought, how perfect is that? So I asked the person at the bookstore to, you know, do you know who did these? And she said, oh, yes, I'll call him for you. And she did. And he said, just give her as many as she needs. And I just thought that was so generous of him. So after the event, I decided I needed to look him up. And interestingly enough, no one could tell me where he lived except that he lived behind the gas station in Bellinas. And so I did venture out to go and find him and thank him. And I did. And when I walked in to his place, I walked into a world like none other I have ever experienced.
We should say that for those who don't know, Bellinas is a promontory, the very south end of Point Reyes, north of Stinson Beach, that kind of sticks out into the Pacific Ocean and has a kind of a remote feel to it. And it's absolutely a beautiful place.
It is. It's a very small it's a small town that does not have signs, and that's also addressed in the movie. But it's a very interesting place, Bellinas. It's sort of a representation of a microcosm of America in a way. There are people that are wealthy there, and then there are people who are marginalized, live in the bushes, live in their vans, and it just taught me a lot about humility and about life. And this film, you know, I was very inspired to make this film after I met Peter Lee and his zany friends.
Yeah, so when you started saying when you walked into where he lived behind the gas station, I'm assuming it was in a house.
Yes.
what did you see?
Well, I saw this area filled with paintings that were strewn all over the yard that had probably two dozen cats, and they were on top of the paintings, and they were not being taken care of. Mm-hmm. And there were either even people living, using them as lean-tos to live in them. Peter never refused anybody that needed a place to stay. And he always said, you know, you always have a dry place to stay here. And so there were many, many people living with him that he took care of. And they would do work in exchange for living there. But I saw a lot of paintings, a lot of cats, a lot of people. It took me probably 10 minutes to get by him, his bodyguards, Stephen, to get into him, that were sort of outside making sure that nobody came in that wasn't supposed to be there. And I met a guy that was his butler and someone that was his driver. And, you know, there was a whole cast of these motley characters. And I went and knocked on the door, and he knew I was coming. And they went and said, okay, you can, Peter said to come in. And he had walls in his house that were made up of paintings. It was just unbelievable. There were paintings everywhere, and lots of people. And back in the back of the house, in a bedroom, there sat this incredible steel blue eyes, this man that was just sitting on the edge of his bed. And he was standing and walking when I met him. Now he's bedridden. Mm-hmm. And he was dressed in a purple floppy hat and was very, very friendly, very welcoming, and developed a friendship with him.
And how old was he when you met him?
He was 90 years old last year. He just turned 91. He actually turned 91 Christmas Eve. Hmm. And so he was really, it was 3 years earlier than that I had met him. And I decided that I would go back with the camera and film him for one day. And so then 3 years later, I went back out and decided that I would continue to film him and do a documentary about him.
Oh, okay.
And that took about 3 weeks.
And what happened if there, you filmed him once and then there was a 3-year gap before you started filming in earnest? What changed in that 3 years that inspired you to actually make the film?
Well, I think that I wanted to try to get to know Peter better. I wanted to be able to get to know the people in town so that they did not feel intimidated that I was an outsider. Mm. I had to hang out a lot at Smiley's Saloon. They do not accept people outside of their town very well. Mm-hmm. And many of them are xenophobics. They warmed up to me after a while, but it took some time. And then there's also the issue of being able to gather the money up to be able to actually film it and film it efficiently.
I'm speaking with Wendy Elkin, who's a filmmaker whose new movie is playing tomorrow at the Sacramento Film and Music Festival at the Crest. I haven't seen the film, but I imagine Bolinas is an amazing backdrop for it as well. And did you tie his paintings into the film? Is that as a filmmaker, it must have been an interesting challenge to capture this scene.
Well, it was very difficult just in the editing alone. I mean, my editor Andrew Kaluzinski deserves a lot of credit because him and the cinematographer Linus Phillips, they did an incredible job because it is an extremely beautiful place. And in editing, that's sort of where the magic happens. A lot of his paintings are about Bolinas, and so many times when you see his paintings in the movie and you'll see the backdrop, it'll be one and the same. But it's an extraordinarily beautiful place that I can understand why the people want to protect it.
Mm-hmm. Now, is this going to be going to a lot of film festivals, or is it going to go into a general release? How do you see this
well,
going?
It's going to do the film festival circuit first. And then, you know, the idea though is to get a distributor, mm-hmm. and I think that I think it's a really good film. I think it's an important film for people to see because it does cover several issues. You know, it does talk about the aging process in our culture today. How mm-hmm. this man is doing it his own way. I mean, he could go in assisted living, and he chooses not to because he wants to be free.
And it will be showing at the Crest Theater at 3:30 tomorrow, Saturday afternoon. And we wish you luck with that.
Thank you so much. I hope everyone gets to see the film festival because there are many, many good films that will be shown there.
Well, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And that's Insight for today. I'm David Watts-Barton of SacramentoPress.com. Jeffrey will be back on Tuesday. Insight's theme song was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producers are Lynn Weaver and Lynn Cazares. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard.